Hey up, and welcome to the Strategy Sessions. My name is Andy Jarvis. I am the host of the show and the Strategy Director at Eximo Marketing. Today, I am joined by Pep Leyer. He's the CEO at Winter and will tell us all about what Winter is and how it works. But Pep has this amazing CV where he's grown companies. He's been a first mover in a lot of markets. He was building websites when most people still have black and white TVs. He's done some amazing things. This episode came around via LinkedIn. Pep put up a post that says, the story is the strategy. And me, being a marketing strategist and being, let's be honest, that guy who likes to pick a fight on LinkedIn sometimes, I was like, that's not right. That's not what a strategy is. I'm going to tell Pep. I'm going to tell him I think he's wrong. So rolled my sleeves up and up I jumped and went, started tapping on the keyboard and started telling Pep why I thought he was wrong. I may be overplaying this a little bit. I jumped in with a different opinion and a different angle on what I thought the story is, the strategy, where it was wrong, where it was right, that sort of thing. But after a couple of comments backwards and forwards, I just sent Pep a DM. I was like, listen, would you come on the podcast and we can discuss this? Because it's probably a much more nuanced discussion than we're getting talking on a LinkedIn thread anyway. And he was like, yeah, let's do it. And do it he does, right? So we talk about that, the story is the strategy. That's coming up right at the top of the interview. But then we also discuss his career, and he has such an amazing career. Like I said, been a first mover in so many industries, and even the story of how Winter came about, just fantastic. So dive in and have a listen. And we also talk about something right at the end that's really close to my heart, which is events and in-person events being superior to online events. That is the hill I am willing to die on, right? I will fight anyone who tells me that an online event is better than an in-person event. It's just not, right? It's about meeting, it's about people, it's about energy, it's about all sorts of things. It's not just the content from the stage. And Pep, me and him are connected in the soul when it comes to this. So, right, enough of me waffling about this episode. Just tune in and carry on listening, right? So here comes Pep. Yeah, Pep, how are you doing?
I'm kicking ass, man. How are you?
I'm top of the world. Thank you very much. Top. And listen, and thank you for coming on the podcast, because my first interaction with you was one of those classic internet moments. You put up a post on LinkedIn that I disagreed with, and I was the guy who jumped in the comments going, Pep, I disagree with what you've said. So thank you for coming on to tell me why I'm wrong as well. So thanks.
Pleasure is all mine.
So let's start with that post where I jumped in 2 feet first. There was a line in the post, I think the headline of it was, the story is the strategy. And I jumped in and I was like, no, it's not. That's not right. That's not right. So talk to us about that post and kind of what was behind it and why the story is the strategy.
Yeah, so obviously if we define what is a strategy, that the definition is not. It's a story, right? So, but if we break a strategy down into components, whatever framework you want to follow, there's always the winning aspiration part, like the shared understanding of success. So like, where are we going? What are we trying to do to begin with? And so this really can be and should be a story. What are we building? And in the story you decide to tell to the market really informs a lot of your product strategy decisions, marketing strategy decisions, and et cetera. So let's take a different example. So if I'm building the hotel chain Ritz-Carlton, mm-hmm. right, and they've grown tremendously over the last 20 years. You know, they were a no name in the 90s, and now it's a big name in the luxury hotel space. So they're telling the story of huge commitment to excellence and devotion. And of course, I'm using my own words here. I don't know how they exactly phrase it. And then how you deserve it and the very best is still exists and all this thing. That's the overarching story of the, like, you deserve luxury and the very best. And now in order to, and so the whole company gets aligned around the story. I know what we are, what are we about and all that stuff. And now when we make product decisions in terms of what is a check-in process like to the hotel, or what is, like, they have this thing where every person at a Ritz-Carlton, let's say it's a gardener, should be able to solve every problem. Oh, the sheets on my bed were not changed. You tell the gardener, and the gardener says, I'm very sorry, I will fix it right away. And they can, and they will. Mm-hmm. So, you know, just as an example. Or what it also does is so for instance, Zuora, the subscription billing company, they tacked on to this the story of the world is going into a subscription economy. So don't just get customers, get subscribers. You know, everything is going in on a subscription model basis. And they started telling the story in like 2009 or something, where nobody even believed that story. And so this is the overall story. And now when their salespeople, for instance, pitch Zuora in sales meetings, the subscription economy story sets the context for the features. It's not like, oh, you can do this feature, this thing with Zuora. It's more like, do you want to join the subscription economy and play a role? And then there's, of course, there's always the winners in this today pursuing this strategy of joining the subscription economy are doing this. Losers are sticking with the old ways. Mm-hmm. And so you create winners and losers. There's a split. And if you want to join the winners, here are the things you need to, you know, implement, let's say. And then now it's like, oh, well, Zuora enables you to do this and that and that. And so it creates context, a winning aspiration. And really, it's a leadership tool inside the company to rally everybody around the same cause. So TLDR, it's part of the winning aspiration.
Yeah. And look, the Ritz-Carlton come up when I do presentations. I talk about them a lot. They used to, don't know if it still is, but they used to have a brilliant mission statement, which was, we are ladies and gentlemen serving ladies and gentlemen. Have they been?
Exactly. And the CEO wrote an excellent book about how they did it and how every person that works for Ritz-Carlton buys into that mission. And like, there's this story, and like, they opened this new hotel in Jamaica, and all these people that applied to work there had never ever worked at a hotel before. And so first day of opening of a new hotel, they show up in their very best clothing, you know, like going to a wedding or something, or the Queen of England is coming to for a visit, you know. And then the CEO of Ritz-Carlton is like, well, hey, like, we have uniforms, like, so why are you dressed up like super fancy? Well, because we are the ladies and gentlemen here, you know. It's like, oh, well, that makes sense.
Okay, they buy in, and that the way they drive it through the whole organization, it's fantastic, right? And
yeah,
it's really good to see, and it's one of the examples I think of that mission statement being used properly. And there's so many vague and terrible mission statements, right? That's one of the ones that always sticks in my head, and I really love it.
Exactly, and I think a story is a better mission format for a mission statement. Like, what are we trying to do here? We're not trying to make the world CO2 neutral or whatever. That's kind of a boring one-liner. But I'd rather if you tell a story of what's happening, what is the change, you know, the climate, blah, blah, blah. You know, it's a more impactful thing. People buy into it.
And I think we, as people, as humans, and the bit I love about the line, the stories, the strategies, that, you know, people remember stories. They remember that narrative. And, you know, some people claim, oh, look, we've been telling stories since caveman days, right? And that's why stories stick with us. I don't know if that's true, right? I'm not an anthropologist. But I know people remember stories. We pass them down through generations, oral storytelling traditions, right?
You don't Absolutely. I read a lot of books, and like in 5 years later, I forget about what the thing was, but I remember the examples, like the stories of how somebody did something.
The Grimm brothers, right? They're not like, you don't remember sort of how many percentage of the three little piggies didn't get something or whatever, right? You just remember the story, and stories mm-hmm. get enhanced and embellished, and we remember them, and it brings us to life, and it presses our button. So I love its way of communicating it. And I think the problem with a lot of strategy is that it sits at C-suite level in the boardroom, doesn't drive down through the organization like Ritz-Carlton did with it. And therefore there's a disconnect between, you end up with this strategy and execution, like it's two separate things.
That exactly. And together. It's written in this boring business jargon language. It's like, well, and yeah. then it's going to live on your Google Drive, and nobody's going to ever look at it. Or hopefully the management is better than that. But
yeah, but then what you do is you have another offsite, you call a consultant. I come in, or someone else comes in, we charge you a great fee. We come away 3 days later, waving a bit of paper around, and go, yes, look, we've got another strategy. And do the same things over and over again, and business as usual carries on. Mm-hmm. So I am absolutely on the page. If you've got a story you can tell, a rallying cry or whatever you want to call it, North Star, it doesn't matter what you call it.
Yeah.
You have a story you can tell the board. You have a story you can tell the organization. You give them a cause to get behind.
Exactly. And when companies are confused about what should our North Star metric be, if you're aligned around the same story, it becomes so much easier to agree on those key metrics.
Yeah. And then that's the, you start at the top and work your way down. So this is the story and these are the things we're working on. So look, you might be listening to this now thinking, okay, well, why was Andy climbing into this post then and going, well, I disagree with you, right? I disagree with you. If that you're both in complete agreement, the story is really important. So to me, where I came from a disagreement perspective was, we had a guest on the podcast maybe a year ago called JP Castlin, who
I know him. Yeah,
you know JP, right? So JP's brilliant. He was a lawyer, and he's probably more of a business consultant than
I love his consultant. Substack. It's the best newsletter out there by far.
Yeah, right. So I'll put a link in the show notes. If you don't get JP's weekly email, it is incredible, and pay for the extra bits because that's definitely worth having.
Totally. But,
and JP, 10-15% commission lifetime would be great. Thank you very much if you listen. But JP wrote a piece in Marketing Week where he talked about his frustration between the law, where a legal term has a very precise definition, and marketing, where no term has a precise definition. So when I say strategy and what someone else says a strategy, it could well be two different things. And one of the exercises I do with my clients a lot of the time, we want you to come in and help us write a marketing strategy. The first thing we do is like, what do you mean by a marketing strategy? Because to some people, they just mean a plan. Some people mean a collection of tactics. Some people mean the thing I would call a strategy. And some people sit around and go, listen, I don't really know, right? We just think we need a strategy and we don't really know.
Totally.
And
for sure. So, I mean, like they're all the strategy frameworks, like if you want to do the playing to win, Roger Martin, or like the good strategy, bad strategy, Rummelt, or Castlin's own ABCD. They all have some form of a winning aspiration, whatever it might be called, right?
And that's, so they all have that story bit in them. And but the problem, the bit I had with your post was like, people are going to look at this and go, right, if we nail the story, we've nailed the strategy.
Ah, yes.
And that almost was the bit that sort of set me going, right, I must tell Pep that he's wrong. And because it feels like there's such a misunderstanding of what strategy is to so many people, that if we feel we've nailed the story, that's it, everything else goes away. And I'm like, no, we've got...
Right.
Depending
that's
on...
Challenge with social media is like, because like every I'm a frequent poster on LinkedIn, Twitter. It's a strategic play for me. I talk about strategy often a lot, and so I assume a lot of my readers have been following me for a long time. Mm-hmm. So focusing on a single post is kind of like taking things out of context. Didn't you see what I wrote about 2 weeks ago? Like, oh, you know,
it's. You have an audience, right? And you talk to your audience, we're talking sound bites, or not sound bites, but we're talking in single posts, and there is a body of work there, and you've got a podcast as well, which has another kind of layer to the information that you share. It is an interesting point, though. You say with social posts that we do take them out of context. I took yours out of context, right?
For
it's a funny medium for that, isn't it? Social, where every individual bit stands on its own, but is also part of a collective.
Yes, and also there's limited space in terms of character count and also in terms of how much shit people are willing to read on social media. So obviously you're going to have to leave stuff out. You can't like, it's not like a 700-page textbook where you're like, you define everything very carefully. I'm not optimizing at all to cover every use case, every edge case. Oh, is this what I said correct when this happens? In fact, in social media, if you want to be controversial or call out the haters, it's actually good for you for your post reach, right?
Yeah, and this is although hopefully Facebook's on the other end of this at the moment, where they've been riding the storm of negativity for so long that it seems to now be affecting their active user base. But that's probably a different discussion for a different day, isn't it? On that sort of podcast. But beyond your post, I have then sort of since. As the algorithm works, I've engaged with a couple of your posts because I had the little disagreement, and then saw the rest of your content, which introduced me to your podcast as well, which is a delight, right? The production values are way higher than the strategy sessions, and it's a great listen. 30 minutes, B2B SaaS leaders giving some great lessons. It's called How to Win. How long have you been going at the podcast then? And, you know, how are you enjoying the hosting journey?
I've been doing it a little over a year now. And I've been a content creator for as long as I can remember. My main medium always used to be writing. You know, like I built my first company and my name in blogosphere, you know, writing blog posts. And so now recently it's Twitter and LinkedIn, my main mediums, because I don't have time to write blog posts anymore. Mm-hmm. But I always wanted to do a podcast. And so what held me back for the longest time was I didn't want to do yet another podcast, because, you know, whatever medium it is, there's so much of everything out there.
Yeah.
So I wanted to have something unique, a unique format, a unique perspective. And when I launched the podcast, actually, I had three concepts in mind, and I recorded episodes for each of these different concepts. And then while recording it, I felt, oh, this one actually has legs and I enjoy doing it and the format kind of flows. Mm-hmm. And these other episodes with other, you know, formats, I just discarded them. Even though I recorded them, I never used them. And so I've been having fun. So I mainly do it because I'm actually interested in the subject matter, how to grow companies,
yep.
What separates winners from losers,
mm-hmm.
and relationship, you know, building aspect of it.
I found podcasting, it just felt like my natural home, right? If anyone who's ever met me will know, I love talking, right? And it just felt like a natural conversational medium for me. And it took me forever to write the blog, and it felt painful, but I could sit and talk to mm-hmm. people forever. So it just felt like a really natural home. And you get to meet great guests like you, Pep. So I love
yeah.
that. So the podcast is called How to Win. There's a link in the show notes if you want to go and find it. And the first thing I want to pick you up on is in your introduction, it says, I don't do fluff, I don't do filler, I don't do emojis. It's the last bit that worries me. I'm not sure if me and you can be friends now.
Well, I actually do a little bit of emojis, but it just sounds cool.
Yeah. So it's a great introduction, but you then looking at, is it strategy? Is it look? How do these companies that do well win? Over the year that you've been doing it, what are the kind of key themes that keep coming again and again from the companies who are winning? What are you learning?
Yeah. So let's start with what's luck. And actually, like between you and me, I've recorded multiple founder CEO interviews for the show where I did not publish the interview because the founder CEO had no clue. There was no strategy. It's like they stumbled into success. And so their luck is a real thing.
Yeah.
It's like, and examples are like, you start a company at a time when something in the external world happened that needs your service.
Mm-hmm.
So COVID happened. There was a massive boom in e-commerce. And so if you study their, I don't know, SMS service for e-commerce companies around, you know, 2020, you were in great luck. And so this company grew. And like, if you try to understand, like, what did you do differently? What was the strategic thinking and like competitive landscape? Like nothing. No clue. We're just here, you know? So luck plays a role. And that actually is also how these big winning companies are winning is the inevitable component is that you need to tap into the existing demand. There needs to be demand for your product. And the bigger the market, the bigger the demand, the faster you will grow.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, if you're early to a market that is about to explode, like e-commerce during COVID, that's great timing. That's great luck. Or another thing, like companies like Deel and Oyster and so on that enable you to hire full-time employees all over the world and take care of the taxes, payroll, compliance. Those companies got really big, like from 0 to 100 million, in 1-2 years, just because of the luck of timing, you know, because suddenly the whole world needed it. So that is, I want to say, number one thing is like a lot of people need what you do, and hopefully you're early to the market. And then there's a lot of empty space until number two reason comes in.
Can I jump in and talk? Because I was asked by a group of students about how lucky do you have to be to do well in business, right? And I thought about it for a little bit, and I went back and I was like, I think the things that some people pass off as luck are not luck because it's easier to put it down to luck or than other things. So you mentioned, like I say, the company that built Oyster. Yep. I don't know them, but you know, they built this, so remote working, compliance, taxes, payroll, that sort of thing. And the, you know, you look at it and look, the timing is right. They launched at the right time. But I say to people who've done it, I'm like, well, you know, you've got maybe 20 years in your career of working in this industry. That wasn't luck. You decided to leave your job to build this company. That wasn't luck. That was brave. Now, the timing element may have been luck, but there's 20 years of work gone in to getting lucky. And it was it a golfer who said, the harder I work, the luckier I get, or something like that? And he's like, are we attributing things to luck that are actually maybe more?
Well, there is. Time? There is.
You know, there's an element of.
I see what you're saying. So obviously there's even if you have the best opportunity, you can squander it. And execution needs to be top notch and all that stuff.
Absolutely,
for sure. Yeah. Timing still matters. What you design your business does can be a point of luck. And let me tell you a story. So friends of mine here in Austin, they built this company called Proof, which is kind of like the social media widget when people on your website, they say, hey, Johnny from Birmingham just bought this bag and 22 other people are looking at it, e-commerce widget. They got somewhere and then they built a kind of A/B testing personalization tool, very late entry to the very crowded market. And that tool, never went anywhere. I mean, they made some money, but it was stuck at low revenue.
Mm-hmm.
The founder is telling me I don't know, man. We're smart people. Why aren't we getting more luck? Why aren't we making more money? And they went to Y Combinator and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And then they decided to just abandon ship and build a whole new product. And then OpenAI announced, hey, GPT-3, this new thing. And so they immediately, day one, hopped on that opportunity. Let's build something in this new space. And they built a company that's now called Jasper.ai. Basically went from struggling for years to mm-hmm. insanely successful, raking in millions left and right type of company. Opportunity, timing, So you can totally be super talented, skilled, experienced, but working on the wrong thing.
Yeah, and focused in the wrong place. There's probably a different discussion there to get into it about, and I've seen you talk about this as well on social, about knowing when to leave something behind so you can focus on something else. As a CEO of a company, and you've had a few companies, we'll talk about them as we go through the discussion, but how do you know when to leave something behind, when to bail out and to start something new? Or, you know, because the emotional investment, the financial investment, the time investment is huge in these companies. Well, how do you know when to leave?
Yeah, so sunk cost fallacy will keep you stuck, and also the emotional labor that all the hard work you've put in,
mm-hmm.
that will hold you back. So you gotta be aware that these biases are affecting you. Change starts from awareness.
Mm-hmm.
But then really is I think you need to be honest. How much money do you think your company should be making? And you can look at benchmarks. If your company, if it's your year 7 and you haven't broken 1 million in revenue for, let's say, a SaaS business, dude, it's not happening. Of course, there are edge cases where this has happened, UiPath, I think, took 10 years for the first million, and now they're DecaCorn or something. So it has happened, but the odds are very, very bad, So I want to say, look at it from a purely financial perspective. How much money are you making? What's your growth rate? So back in 2009 or whatever, I started a SaaS company called Traindom, which was build your own course platform, kind of what Teachable is today or Thinkific. And we got to, I want to say, maybe to 10K MRR revenue level.
Mm-hmm.
And then the growth was it was 11K, and then the next month it was maybe 12K, and then dropped back to down to 10K. It was it was zombie territory, not quite alive, but we're not quite dead, but not quite alive either.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so after 2 years, I was like, we're still making 10K a month. I mean, I have better things to do. And as soon as I decided to kill the business, which was should have done it way earlier, because for all these emotional reasons, I delayed. And I started my next business, CXL. The success was instantly way better. Like I was working on things that had more demand. It was just a better business, better timing, all that stuff.
Yeah, I think it's that emotional investment, and it's probably the easiest person to lie to is yourself. I think.
Oh yeah.
Sometimes they go, maybe because we're just if I fix this, or we're just around this corner, and maybe if I change that, and you have that epiphany that now,
and also like, let's say failed startup founders when they're trying to sell off their assets, like, okay, I'm gonna have to abandon this, but I'm gonna see try to if I can recover something, right? And they try to sell off their failing SaaS business, and often they don't value the business the way businesses are valued. Like in SaaS, it would be a multiple on your revenue,
mm-hmm.
Based on your growth rate and whatever. They say, well, my developers put in 1,000 hours, so let's calculate hourly. Like they do that kind of math. Oh yeah, you can buy it for $20 million. So whatever it is. It's like, well, your business only makes $10K a month. We're like, so I'll buy it for 200.
Yeah, and it's the illusions and the delusions of you that you tell yourself about business is always a tough one, isn't it? Always a tough.
Oh, for sure, yeah. And how much sweat equity you put into something means nothing at all.
Yeah, there's very little value, especially if you're trying to sell it as a fire sale. There's definitely no value to sweat equity.
Nobody cares.
No, I'm going to throw another line at you from the podcast from Anand Sanwal. He said something along the lines of be competitor aware, but customer obsessed. And I wrote it down because I was like, I love this, right? I often say to customers, stop copying your competitors. They don't know what they're doing either, right?
Yes.
So many companies are just hyper-focused on what the competition are doing that they forget to look at what the customers are telling them. And he said that, and I was like, Jesus, guy, I love this. What do you make of that line, and what did you make of Anand? He was brilliant.
Yeah, well, he's an example of a company. They pivoted at 8 million ARR or thereabouts. And now they're, I think, over 100. Imagine the guts to change what you're doing at around 8 million a year. Yeah. This would be a dream revenue for a lot of startups.
Yeah.
But they pivoted. They abandoned the old ship and built a new one. About that line, yeah. So if you look at any business category, especially tech, like sameness is pervasive. Like every competitor looks like just like their next competitor.
Mm-hmm.
And why is it? I mean, A is because they're all looking at the competitor. Oh, they have that feature. We also, excuse me, they also need that feature, right? So it's this constantly copying each other. Another thing is, if you don't have a brand vision, like you don't have a strong identity, story of what you're building,
mm-hmm.
you wanna be customer obsessed, and then you do everything that the customers tell you. So there's this famous story of how Tesla did focus groups with moms for their Model X. And they're like, hey, what do you want about a family car when you drive your kids around? And the things that they learned about what moms want from cars was identical to what Toyota found out when they're interviewing moms for their Toyota Sienna minivan. So both could, now they have the exact same insights, they could build the exact same car because they all want the same thing. So it's like, yes, listen to the customer. And of course, you want to be customer obsessed, but you have to have your own vision too.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, you're going to end up building the exact same thing. And I think if three startups would start today in the exact same space, but they wouldn't be able to look at what everybody else is doing, what the competitors are doing, they would build wildly different companies, I think.
Yeah. And there's so having said I'm not an anthropologist, right? There's actually some anthropological evidence of what you've said there. So in Australia, Tasmania drifted away from the mainland over a period of time, right? Tectonic movements
yep.
don't happen quickly. But the Aboriginal tribes of Tasmania became cut off from their ancestors on the mainland, which actually gave anthropologists, and let's not get into the ethics of the great white anthropologists who went over there and studied Aborigines, not in very ethical ways, right? But what it gave them a great case study of what happens when stuff goes off in different directions. So they effectively were the same people separated by water, but they had no interaction with each other. and ended up developing the Tasmanian Aborigine population is really different in lots of ways to every other Aborigine population on the island of Australia, because they had no interaction with them at all. And it's almost, you take that to a business point, if you like say, if you stop looking at what's going on around you and your competitors, you would go off in a very different direction. Definitely end up going differently.
Totally. I have these discussions all the time inside my team where of course you want to be competitive aware. So they say, oh, like they are doing it that way. And I looked at these competitors, this is the way they do it. And I often say, like, I don't give a shit the way they do it. You know, so like we have our own model here. We have our own thing going on here. I mean, you can of course take inspiration from, if there's obviously a better idea than yours, the way you do things is objectively worse. Sure, you want to change course.
Yeah.
There is a time and place, but like also human beings, we're made to copy, you know, as children, just we mimic the parents, and like, this is how we learn to walk and talk. And I mean, and also like DNA, like by definition, we're the copies of people that came before us. Right?
Yep.
So copying is very natural behavior. We just gotta resist it.
Which actually gets us nicely into winter, because I think with winter, as in I'm looking out my window in Ireland here, and winter's definitely come while we've been on this podcast. It's gone from bright sun to annoyingly heavy rain. But winter, as in your company, WYNTER, which is messaging for B2B companies. And I think I want to kind of throw this out, because I think what you're saying there's a lot of sameness in the industry.
Mm-hmm.
In products particularly, where copying features is relatively easy.
Yep.
So messaging is the one place that you can stand out, right? They can't copy your story. They can't copy your message. Well, they can, but they can't do it as well. Is that where Winter comes in, helping companies find that space to be able to communicate better with their customers?
Yeah, so there are two aspects to it. It's like, I mean, the purpose of a business is to create a customer. Without customers, there's no business. And the only way you do it is by sending some sort of messaging out towards the customers through whatever medium. Is it in person, email, sales, website? You know, that doesn't matter. And to get more customers, you need your messaging to improve. So it's more compelling, more clear, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So it's this immensely powerful tool, if you want to call it that. Yet, until recently, there was no way to measure how effective is your messaging. You know, like using web analytics, we can measure every click, every scroll on our websites, but no clue how the words are working. Like what's confusing, what's unclear, what needs improvement, what's actually turning people off. Mm-hmm. No clue. And so I had this very problem at my previous company, CXL, where hundreds of sales pages. And I was asking myself, if my ideal customer is reading this sales page, are they like, wow, this is amazing? Or are they like, who cares? Or, you know, what's interesting, what's boring? And so I was like, well, how is it possible that this problem has not been solved yet? And so I jumped on this opportunity. And so with Winter, you can find out two things. A, what does your target customer want, think? What are their pain points, challenges, priorities, mm-hmm. desired gains? And B, you learn when your ideal customer reads your sales pitch on your website or wherever, what do they think of it? Like what do they find compelling, and what do they find off-putting, and all these other things?
So what common, I often refer to B2B as boring to boring. Right, not business to business, boring to boring, because B2B companies love talking product features. Our product does this.
Mm-hmm.
And the prospect sitting at the other end going, I don't give a shit, right? So B2B, boring to boring marketing. Is that one of the common problems you see, that people just blind you with features? Or, you know, is that the sort of thing that you're helping them fix? Or is it sort of...
Yeah. I want to say that it is very feature focused. However, I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing, because also the prospective customer does want to find out, like, what is this tool do, right? They do want to know the features.
Yeah.
The biggest problem is by far is clarity. The prospect comes on the website, they read it, and they still have no clue what this business does. because they use like jargon and fancy buzzwords, and they go into selling the benefits right away. People say, no, I don't even understand what it is, because they're like, they've completely dropped communicating their positioning, which should be the first thing you say in your above the fold, like, what is this and who is it for and what does it enable you to do?
This is that's a huge frustration for me with SaaS products. You go on the website and it'll say something like, we revolutionize communication for B2B org. And you're like, brilliant. But then the only other thing you can see to click on the page is start your free trial now. I'm like, free trial of what?
Exactly.
You want me to trial? I don't even know what you do yet. And you need to try to sell to me.
Exactly. Because that pitch was probably made originally for the VCs who were bedazzled by like the big grand vision, revolutionizing an industry or big TAM. That's great. But your customer is different, right?
Yeah.
And a lot of times, of course, the messaging on the homepage is very political internally.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times it's the brainchild of the CMO or CEO who are very protective of their children. Now, but also at the same time, these people are rational actors and probably very smart people.
Mm-hmm.
And they would change their mind about what the homepage copy needs to say if they only had data on how it lands on the intended recipient. And if they would have data that your target customers have no fucking idea what's going on, it would change. And that's a big thing that Winter gives, is this data on how your messaging lands, and it helps create internal alignment of what we should say instead. So a lot of times there's a lot of infighting. Product wants to say this, marketing wants to say that, CEO has another idea, SDRs want to use other messaging, you know, so there's no consistency or maybe there's just a lot of fighting.
So you're bringing the data to the argument so that you can start to make better decisions because of that.
Which... Exactly right. Yeah.
There's an element here though with Winter that you are, like you said, you saw a problem that couldn't be solved. Oh no, sorry. Let me rephrase that. You saw a problem that hadn't been solved, so you built Winter. Not mm-hmm. it couldn't be solved because you've solved it. So you built Winter. So you were right at the beginning, right at the early days of this industry of solving that problem. Looking back through your CV, there's maybe a couple of other times you've done that. You were a web developer in 2002 when most people weren't really, you know, the internet is not what it is now, right? And there's probably a lot of listeners of this podcast who might not have even been born in 2002 who just don't quite understand, but it really wasn't the same as it is now. And you also started CXL as a conversion optimization agency in 2011, which was certainly in the, you know, the stone age of that industry as well.
Mm-hmm.
Do you just love getting in at the beginning, you know, getting in at the ground floor and building the sector? Is that your thing? Are you a forward thinker, or do you just look for that opportunity to go in and go, this is unplowed land, I want to get in there?
I mean, it's a bit of luck, and like at an early young age, I wasn't conscious of this, and you know, I was just interested in computers, and that led into, you know, the web is new hot thing that was cool, and so on. So I became a web developer. Conversion optimization thing was actually, it came about, I was like a marketing consultant, like all purpose. I do SEO, PPC, you know, this and that. But I realized that I need to pick a niche. Because all purpose being a generalist like is a road to nowhere. Already back in 2011, it seemed like the internet is crowded. And of course, little did I know. Yeah. I mean, like in SEO, like Rand Fishkin was already big, and you know, Moz, SEO Moz, yeah, I guess,
yeah.
Back then.
SEO Moz as it was, yeah.
Yeah. And so I was like, okay, so I need to, like, should I go into SEO now? That seems too crowded. Should I go into PPC? Seems too crowded. And the way I measured it was, number of agencies doing it, and also how many blogs were out there, and were they any good? And then I looked at CRO, conversion optimization. I was like, well, very few players that I can see, and their blog posts are crap. It's like very mediocre. I was like, I can dominate this. And so I decided to just based on that to just focus on CRO. And sure enough, like we dominated the hell out of it. I mean, Conversion Excel was the company, now called CXL. Like we dominated the search engine rankings with our blog posts because nobody else was really doubling down on content marketing back then. And we blogged like our life depended on it. And sure enough, became the kings of that universe. Yeah.
Yeah. And the CXL rebranded at some point in its lifetime to Spiro. What was behind the rebrand? Because Conversion XL seems like a great name for it. Was there kind of internal pushing behind that, or what happened there?
So things happened where, like, we started as Conversion XL, and then maybe 3-4 years after we launched, we added on a conference called Conversion XL Live. And that's a mouthful. Like, Conversion XL is already a long word. And we started noticing that people themselves started to abbreviate Conversion XL as CXL. And then maybe 5 years into the agency, I personally got tired of consulting. And it's like, well, what else can I do in this business if I don't want to be? And I was like the cover boy, you know, like people wanted to work with me. I was a name people knew. And then we surveyed our email list, which was pretty sizable at the time, like 100,000 people or something. And basically asking them, like, what else would you want to buy from us if we were smart enough to sell it to you? And they said, like, courses and ebooks and things like that. And so I decided to build like a branch of the business that we called Conversion XL Institute, another mouthful, as a sub brand. So there's agency and there's content business. And the content business, I mean, year one, I think we made $250,000, and year two, we made $1 million. And it's like, wow, this is going places, right? Like, where success is fast, especially thinking back to my SaaS company that never got past 10K a month revenue. And then fast forward, like when we had Conversion XL Institute and so on, it was like, this is like too long. So we changed Conversion XL to CXL. Just, it would be shorter to say. Mm-hmm. But then around like 2020, 4 years into the content business or the e-learning business, we ran into this problem where our company was doing two separate things, agency services as well as e-learning business. And it's very hard for a company to stand for two different ideas. Like, what are we? And some people thought we're only agency and some people knew us as only e-learning. It was confusing. And so we decided to also basically cut it in half and spin one of them out. And we decided to spin the agency, even though that was the original business, into a separate brand. And the reason was that most of the email list of 100,000 something people, they would rather buy the down market product, the subscription to our content, rather than an agency, which is like 20,000 a month type of thing. And so hence we let the new e-learning business inherit all that.
Gotcha. So there's got a lot of thought gone into it then, which was great. Because I love the stories of rebrands as to, and some of them, like you were saying about the things you learned from your guests, some of them are, look, well, actually, I'll just, we don't like this anymore. And some of them are built around solving real problems for the business, which is, you know, where yours was going. So
totally. And also, if I think about the long term and, you know, possible exit scenarios in the future, not that I'm fishing for it, Who will want to buy a business that is both e-learning or an agency, right? Maybe nobody or very few. But there's companies that buy agencies, there's companies that buy e-learning businesses, right? So there also that played a kind of a role in my decision-making, like thinking 10 years into the future or whatever.
And you've still got the live event taking place, which is coming back fairly soon after a COVID break. When is that, October time it's taking place?
Yeah, it's like the last week of October, October 25, 26, CXL Live in Austin, Texas.
Excellent. Now, that's quite a trip to make from Belfast, Northern Ireland, so I probably won't be coming. But you said something about how magical it is to have people coming back into events, which is something close to my heart. I did endless events on Zoom and Teams or whatever across, but I'm back to conference speaking. I was out in Philadelphia recently. I'm going to Macedonia next week. These are great. Like, being back at events in rooms with people, there's something about it that is just magical, isn't it?
Totally. Totally. I mean, you don't travel to in-person events for content, because like that's going to be all on YouTube anyway. You know, like it's silly to pay the flight and the hotel and the ticket to just for the event. I went to Sastre a couple of weeks ago now. I didn't see a single talk, maybe one, over 3 days. You know, that's not what live events are about. Live events are about relationships. So chatting up with people you already know, like deepening your existing relationship and building new ones. And you can't do that online. I mean, it's very, very hard. Don't even get me started with virtual events that they do zero for relationship building. Zero. It's an effective medium for content, not for relationships. So I'm a huge believer in relationships. I've built my businesses on top of relationships. That's how I make most of my money still, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Look, virtual relationships and virtual conferences were a necessary evil during COVID, right? They were a crutch for the organizations to keep those businesses going. But even the ones I went to where I was presenting or ones where I went to when I was just attending, the way that they tried all sorts of things to create that networking just didn't work, did it? Right? You know, like,
no,
fair play to everybody who tried, same, but it just didn't work. So to be back in person is great. This show will be out before then. So if anyone is in or near Austin, Texas, what's the website? I'll put it in the show notes, obviously, so people can know.
CXL.com/live.
Perfect. We shall hopefully give that a promotion. We are coming towards the end, towards the top of the hour, where we wrap up and let you get back to running a business. So what I have is a couple of different questions just to wrap up with. So my first question is about books or reading or podcasts, or we've plugged yours anyway. But where do you go? What books do you read, or what recommendations would you give people to kind of stay up to date?
Yeah, I mean, I read books based on like what problem am I thinking about today? What I think I could use help with. If I had to recommend one lesser-known book that any business owner would benefit from a lot, it's called Road Less Stupid by Keith Cunningham. It will blow your mind. I especially recommend the audiobook, the author narrated. Road Less Stupid. It's so good.
What was the guy's name again? Sorry?
Keith Cunningham.
Keith Cunningham. Brilliant. I'll write that down. I'll get that in the show notes. It sounds like a great book as well. Even just from the title, I'm like, must get that ordered.
Basically, the TLDR is like entrepreneurs pay a lot of stupid tax for making stupid mistakes that could be avoidable. And so this book is about basically how to run your business without paying the stupid tax.
Yeah, that definitely feels like it's got a window into my soul when it comes to stupid decisions. That's me. Listen, Pet, thank you very much for your time. It's been great to hear from you. It's been great to chat and to find out a little bit more about what you do. And it's been a pleasure to share some time with you. Thank you.
Thank you, Andy.